Once they had arrived, Lorena asked Falcon to wait for a moment in the anteroom while she went in to see the secretary. A moment later, Secretary Taft himself came to greet Falcon.
Well, Mr. McAllister, Lorena just told me what a hero you are.
Oh, nothing heroic about it, Mr. Secretary. A pistol against knives is just common sense.
A pistol against knives is common sense. Oh my, that is a good one. Well, do come in, Mr. McAllister.
Thank you.
Or should I say Colonel McAllister? I can guarantee you your commission will be approved.
Falcon followed Secretary Taft into his office. Lorena stood by the secretary's desk, smiling at him.
Miss Wood, if you don't mind, would you act as a witness while I administer the oath?
I would be happy to.
If you would please, Mr. McAllister, raise your right hand.
McAllister responded as directed, then repeated the oath after the secretary.
I, Falcon McAllister, having been appointed a reserve officer in the Army of the United States in the grade of Lieutenant Colonel, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign or domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservations or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which I am about to enter. So help me God.
Congratulations, Colonel.
Thank you.
Later, after their meeting, Falcon and Secretary Taft left the secretary's office. Custer was waiting just outside.
Ah, General Custer, is there something I can do for you?
Yes, Mr. Secretary. Last Friday, when I spoke with General Sherman, he told me that he asked you to write a letter to the managers of the impeachment trial, requesting that I be released so I can return to my command.
Yes, he did ask me to write such a letter.
And did you?
I was ordered not to. I was directed to designate another officer to command the 7th.
You were ordered not to write the letter? Mr. Secretary, correct me if I'm wrong, sir, but the only person who can order you on such matters would be the President of the United States.
You are not wrong, Custer.
I cannot believe that Grant would endanger the entire campaign for political retaliation. This is unconscionable. Where is General Sherman? I must speak with him.
The General is in New York. Perhaps if you went directly to the President to plead your case, he would reconsider.
I have been to see the President. For 3 days I have been to see him, and today he kept me cooling my heels in his office for 5 hours. Finally, Colonel Ingalls happened by and interceded with the President for me, but Grant sent word that he would not receive me.
I'm sorry.
Yes, well, being sorry doesn't get the job done, does it? Falcon, I'm sorry you had to be privy to this.
No need to apologize. I can understand your frustration.
When are you going back?
I leave on the evening train.
I'm going back as well.
Are you sure you want to do that, Custer? If I understand you, you have not yet made a courtesy call on the President.
Oh, I've called, all right. The President didn't receive me, but I called. In the meantime, General Sherman has approved my departure. So unless you, Mr. Secretary, give me a direct order to remain in Washington, I will leave this very evening.
I will not order you to stay, but I'm sure you understand that no authorization of mine can override the President's wishes.
The President has not specifically ordered me to stay.
Custer looked over at Falcon and smiled slyly.
What route will you take back?
Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Denver.
Good, good. We'll be together as far as Chicago.
May 4th, 1876, Union Station, Chicago. In Chicago, Falcon and Custer were due to go their separate ways, Falcon to St. Louis and Custer to St. Paul. They were standing on the depot platform when an Army captain in uniform approached.
General Custer, sir. General Sheridan's compliments, sir. And he asked that I give you this telegram.
This is from Sherman to Sheridan.
Yes, sir. But as it pertains to you, the General asked that you read it.
To General Sheridan from General Sherman. I am at this moment advised that General Custer left Washington for St. Paul and Fort Abraham Lincoln. Stop. He was not justified in leaving without seeing the President and myself. Stop. Please intercept him and await further orders. Stop. Meantime, let the expedition proceed without him. Stop. Am I under arrest, Captain?
Arrest? No, sir, you aren't under arrest.
So if I told you that I intend to proceed on to St. Paul and plead my case with General Terry, you have no authorization to stop me?
No, sir.
Then kindly inform General Sheridan that if he wishes to see me, he can contact me at St. Paul.
Very good, sir.
As the captain walked away, Custer bowed his head and pinched the bridge of his nose. He was quiet for a long moment. Falcon avoided looking directly at him because he was sure he could see a sheen of tears in his eyes. Custer blinked several times.
You were there, Falcon. You saw what happened. What did I do wrong? Can you answer that for me?
As far as I could determine, you did nothing wrong.
I wonder if you would testify to that effect at my court-martial. I mean, if it actually comes to that.
I don't think it will come to that, but if it does, I will gladly testify on your behalf.
Custer looked to one of the trains that was just pulling into the depot.
That's my train. We'll meet again, Falcon. The best thing about meeting new friends is the opportunity to make them old friends.
I'll get it, Big Grandpa.
Hello? Yes? I'll tell him. Goodbye.
That was Mr. Barquette. He's finished with the repairs to your saddle.
Oh, good.
Getting back to your story, Falcon, what happened next?
To be honest, I never did learn what happened between Custer and General Terry. I just know that I saw him board that train. I'd never seen a more forlorn expression in anyone.
But somehow he got the orders rescinded, didn't he? I mean, he obviously did join his regiment.
I can fill in a few blanks here. That is, if you don't mind my intrusion.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Libby, it's not an intrusion. Where you're concerned, it could never be an intrusion.
I'm not surprised, Falcon, that you saw a sheen of tears in Audie's eyes. General Terry, as I'm sure you know, was in command of the Dakota Territory, and as such, that included Fort Lincoln and the 7th Cavalry. That made him Audie's commander, so it was perfectly proper for Audie to go see him, as to see Sheridan would have been a violation of protocol by going around his direct commander. Some years later, Terry told me that Audie reported to him with tears in his eyes. Audie explained to Terry that everyone in Washington who was in any position of authority had given him permission to leave. But the problem was that he had publicly attacked Grant and his administration, and Grant was not going to let him get away with it. Grant ordered Reno to take command of the 7th. If Grant had his way, all poor Audie could do was remain at the post and watch his regiment leave. Audie begged Terry to help him, and Terry didn't hesitate. After all, Terry had never campaigned against the Indians either, nor had any of his subordinate officers. He wanted Audie to make the expedition, fully as much as Audie wanted to go. Between them, they came up with an appeal that finally worked. Audie sent a telegram to President Grant that read, in part,
"I appeal to you as a soldier to spare me the humiliation of seeing my regiment march to meet the enemy, and I not to share its dangers."
Terry added that, while he had no intent to question the president's orders, that if reasons did not forbid it, Lieutenant Colonel Custer's services would be very valuable with his regiment. Somehow that simple, heartfelt message worked, and President Grant relented. Audie was allowed to proceed directly from St. Paul to Fort Lincoln, there to prepare the regiment for the march.
Libby was quiet for a moment, and Zane Gray leaned forward, then reached across to her. Gently, he took her hand.
Libby, have you ever thought of what might have been? If President Grant had not rescinded his orders, it is entirely possible the general would still be alive today.
I have thought about that, Mr. Gray. Many times. But knowing Audie as I did, he would rather have ridden into the history books with glory than live, only to die many years later in ignominy. Please, Mr. McAllister, go on with your story.
I'll be glad to. After the general and I separated at Chicago, I went directly to Fort Junction.
May 6, 1876. Fort Junction, Colorado Territory. Falcon returned to the fort, and he met with Sergeant Major O'Leary and Major Brisbane.
Falcon, my lad, all the troops have turned out on the parade ground. They're wanting to welcome you back and pay their respects.
Sergeant Major, may I remind you that Colonel McAllister is a genuine colonel now. His commission ratified by the United States War Department. You cannot refer to him as Falcon, my lad.
Sure, and I know that, Major. 'Tis forgetful I am sometimes, being as I am an old man and can't help but think of the Falcon I knew as a boy many years ago. Colonel McAllister, it's a begging your pardon I am for not showing the proper respect.
I believe you mentioned that the troops have formed on the parade ground.
Aye, that they are, Colonel, me lad. That is, Colonel, sir.
Well, we can't keep them standing in the sun now, can we? What do you say we go outside and meet the troops?
Good idea.
Out on the parade ground, the flag of the United States rippled in the breeze. Although the official flag had only 37 stars, this flag had 38 in anticipation of Colorado's upcoming statehood. There were five companies of 60 men each in the Colorado Home Guard. Falcon approached them.
Regiment! Attention! Sir, Colorado Home Regiment all present and accounted for.
Thank you, Sergeant Major. Officers post!
At that command, the company commanders moved into a position at the head of the individual companies.
Pass in review!
The commanding officer of the first company drew even with Falcon. The company commander snapped his head to the right and brought his saber up, hilt to his chin, the silver blade sparkling in the sun as it stood at a 45-degree angle. The right guide of each rank continued to stare straight ahead, while all the other soldiers in the rank turned their head and eyes to the right. Falcon returned the salute of the company commander, then repeated it as each subsequent company passed in review. Later, after the parade was concluded and the soldiers dismissed, Falcon and Brisbane returned to the headquarters building.
I have to hand it to you, Adrian. You have done wonders with these men.
Thank you, sir.
I told Governor Rout that I intend to hold this command only until Colorado is admitted as a state. After that, I will resign, and I will strongly recommend that you be my replacement.
I appreciate the confidence, Colonel.
I suppose that'll mean that you will have to go to Washington and get your commission confirmed.
No, sir, that won't be necessary. I already hold a federal commission.
The post telegrapher came into the headquarters building then, and seeing the two senior officers in discussion, he stood quietly by, unwilling to interrupt them.
Hello, Mr. Potter. Do you have something for me?
Yes, sir. Two telegrams. One from Fort Lincoln, Dakota Territory, and one from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
Fort Lincoln? That must be General Custer. I'll see that one first.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me, Major. I'd like to read what this says.
Certainly, sir.
Fort Lincoln, Dakota Territory, 7th Cavalry, to Colorado Home Guard, Lieutenant Colonel Falcon McAllister, commanding. Colonel McAllister, stop. I've been returned to active duty, and now take pleasure in inviting you to Fort Lincoln, where on the 12th instant, your brother and sister will give a performance for the post. Stop. G.A. Custer, Lieutenant Colonel Brevet Major General, commanding.
Major, how'd you feel about taking over command again for a while?
I'm at your command, sir.
Good. General Custer has invited me to Fort Lincoln to view a performance given by my brother and sister.
And by all means, sir, you must go.
It's just that I hate leaving you again so soon after having been gone for so long.
Believe me, Colonel, I don't mind.
All right, I will go. Mr. Potter, you said there were two telegrams for me.
Yes, sir.
Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to Colorado Home Guard, Lieutenant Colonel Falcon McAllister, commanding. Sir, this is to inform you that two Gatling guns are being transferred to your regiment. Stop. The guns are being shipped by train from Fort Wallace, Kansas, to Denver, and will arrive there on the 9th instant. Stop. Please arrange to have someone pick them up at the location. Stop. Captain Oliver Larkin, supply officer.
Gatling guns.
Falcon showed the telegram to Brisbane.
Did you order Gatling guns?
No, sir, I did not.
Then why on earth would they be sending us Gatling guns?
I don't know, but evidently someone thinks that we need them.
What about the repeating rifles? Any more news on the Henry rifles?
I've had Mr. Potter, the telegrapher, look into it. Apparently the rifles have been misdirected.
Falcon looked over at Potter.
Misdirected to where?
I haven't been able to find out.
Oh, we'll keep trying.
Yes, sir.
If we're lucky, the same thing will happen with the Gatling guns. I know I sure don't want the damn things.
Colonel, We can't just leave them at the railroad depot in Denver. I mean, we are having enough trouble trying to find out what happened to the rifles.
No, I guess you're right about that. According to the telegram, they're supposed to get to Denver on the 9th. If I'm going to be in Fort Lincoln on the 12th, I'll have to leave today.
I see no reason why you cannot go to Fort Lincoln as planned. I can see to the retrieval of the guns.
All right, we'll send someone to get them. I mean, you are right, we can't just leave them there. But let's keep this very quiet, shall we? Let's pick the detail with great care. And I don't want anyone to know about the guns until we actually have them here.
Very well, sir. I'll lead the detail myself.
No, I don't think you should. Seeing someone of your rank making a supply run would be absolutely sure to raise some suspicions. Send Sergeant Major O'Leary.
With or without escort?
We normally send an escort when we pick up supplies, don't we?
Yes, sir. We normally send 4 men, 2 in front and 2 behind the wagon. Perhaps we should double the escort?
No, I don't want this to look any different. 1 wagon, driven by O'Leary, and 4 well-chosen escorts. As far as anyone who sees them is concerned, it'll be just another routine supply run.
When Graham Potter, the civilian telegrapher, returned to his office, he found Willie Crawford sitting at the instrument, sending a message.
Here, what are you doing?
Oh, I was just exchanging greetings with an old part who's a telegrapher in Denver.
You know telegraphy?
Yeah, I was a telegrapher during the war.
Well, you ain't a telegrapher here, so get.
Potter watched as the private hurried out of his office. He was about to send a message, and he didn't want anyone who could read telegraphy hanging around. Locking the door and pulling the shade, Potter sat down to his instrument and began tapping out a message. He didn't notice Crawford, who was standing just outside the door, listening to the taps. May 6, 1876, Copperdale, Colorado Territory. The Copper Penny Saloon was filled with customers, and smoke from dozens of cigars, pipes, and roll-your-own cigarettes gathered in a cloud just below the ceiling. Cleet Harris, Jim Guerin, Jay Bryans, and Ken Richland were sitting on one side of the room.
There's 2 of them, and they're worth $2,000 each.
How in the world'd you come up with 2 Gatling guns?
Well, I haven't come up with them yet, Ken. If I already had the guns, I wouldn't need you.
But you know where to get them, right?
Yeah, I know.
All right. My question still stands. Where'd you find out about them?
Same way I come up with 100 rifles. I got a contact with the Colorado Home Guard.
Where are the guns now? And how do we get them?
They'll be going by wagon from Denver to Fort Junction, Jay.
With a whole army guarding them, no doubt. Can't hardly see the army shipping a couple of Gatling guns out without having a lot of guards.
Only 4 guards.
How do you know?
How do I know? I know for the same reason I know they're coming, and when they're coming.
Harris took a telegram from his pocket and showed it to the others.
Like I said, I got a contact with the Colorado Home Guard. This here telegram is from the telegrapher at Fort Junction.
How'd you get it?
He sent it to me.
Do you trust him?
Hell yeah, I trust him. The telegrapher's my cousin, Graham Potter. He's in for a share.
A whole share?
A whole share.
That ain't no way right. I mean, what, with us doing the work and him getting a whole share?
There wouldn't be nothing to share at all if Potter hadn't arranged to get the guns in the first place.
Guerin, you go along with this?
Yeah, I go along with it.
All right. If you don't have no trouble with it, then I don't reckon I do either.
What about you, Bryans? You got a problem with Potter getting his share?
Nope. As long as I get my share, I ain't got no problem with that.
Good.
What else has your cousin told us we can use?
There's only going to be 5 men with the shipment. Driver, who's an old man, and 4 guards. They're treating this like an ordinary supply run, figuring if they do that, it won't raise no suspicions.
And it would have worked, too, if it hadn't been for your cousin letting us in on it.
When are the guns being shipped?
They get to Denver on the 9th.
You sure we can get $2,000 apiece?
Tell him, Gary.
Cutno said he wanted the guns. Cleet here told him it was going to cost him a lot of money. Cutno said he had a lot of money.
Where do the engines get the money?
They've robbed army payrolls, they attacked wagon trains and took everything. They killed prospectors and express riders and taken everything. Since they don't spend the money amongst themselves, over the years, the money just builds up.
I'll be damned. All right. Sounds good to me.
Now, there is one little detail I haven't mentioned.
What's that?
The sewer up in Montana somewhere. We're going to have to go up there and find him in order to deliver the guns to him.
Yeah, I've been hearing that the Army's planning to get after them engines this summer.
That's right. So that means we're going to have to find him before the Army does. Otherwise, there ain't likely to be anyone left to buy the guns.
Wait a minute. You plan to give them Gatling guns knowing the Army's going after them?
Yeah, that's my plan.
But if the Indians have Gatling guns, won't that be helping Indians kill white men?
You got any kin in the Army?
Nope. Don't think so.
Then don't worry about it. Most of the Army's dumb Irish or Germans anyhow.
Yeah. I guess you're right.
Damn right I'm right.
Harris picked up his beer mug and held it out toward the others.
Now, here's to $2,000.
Damn. I just figured out what I'm going to do with my share of the money.
What's that?
I'm going to use it to outfit myself. Then I'm going into the Black Hills and get me some of that gold they say is just lying around up there.
May 6, 1876, Omaha, Nebraska. The riverboat far west backed away from its moorings at Omaha. Scores of people were gathered on the docks to watch the steamboat begin its journey upriver to the town of Bismarck, Dakota Territory. The paddle wheel, which was in reverse, stopped, then started again, this time rolling forward. For a moment, it did nothing but churn up the water. Then it caught purchase and the boat started moving upstream, searching for the channel. The Far West was a stern-wheeler, shallow-draft, wooden-hull packet boat powered by three boilers. It was 190 feet long and could carry 200 tons and 30 cabin passengers. On this day, though, there must have been at least 70 passengers, many of whom were making the journey on the deck of the steamer. Falcon, who had a cabin, was standing at the stern watching the wheel turn, frothing up the water and leaving a rolling wake for a long way behind the boat.
The first thing I'm going to get me is a three-piece suit with a diamond stick pin on my vest. And I'm going to get me a cane, too. One of them black, shiny canes with a silver head. Then I'm going to walk right down Fifth Avenue in New York and tell them coppers what used to pinch me all them times when I was hungry and I'd take no more than an apple that they can just kiss my rich backside.
With very few exceptions, the passengers were all men, all loud and boisterous, and nearly all from eastern cities and towns. When asked, they would say that they were coming west to make their fortune in gold. Most were clinging to their little treasure of camping or mining equipment, bought from unscrupulous suppliers who were going to make their own fortune from the fortune seekers. Several had maps as well, the maps purporting to show them exactly where to go and giving such details as good water here, adequate firewater here, wild fruit and good fishing here. Falcon, who'd been all through the Dakota Territory, had seen a couple of the maps. They were not only wrong, they were incredibly wrong. Not drawn from any exact knowledge, but simply extrapolated with a lot of imagination from published maps. They put rivers, creeks, and lakes where there were none, mountain passes where only sheer rock walls stood. The men would often retire to a part of the boat where they could find some privacy and sit there and study their maps, learning every detail so they would be well prepared when they started on their quest. Falcon tried to tell one that a good water stream that was on his map didn't exist at all, but the passenger didn't believe him. Falcon was curious as to why there were so many Easterners on board the boat. He managed to find Captain Grant Marsh and decided to ask him that very question.
They are gold hunters. They're going into the Black Hills to get rich.
What makes them think they can get rich in the Black Hills? What they're most likely to get is to have their scalps lifted. Don't they know the Black Hills belongs to the Sioux? In fact, the Black Hills are sacred to the Sioux.
That doesn't matter a whit to them. These men all have gold fever, and nothing's going to stop them.
Well, surely when they get out there, the Army will prevent them from going into Indian territory.
I don't think even the Army can stop them. And from reading that fool article in the newspaper, I'm not sure Custer even wants to stop them.
What newspaper article?
Lord, Falcon, you must be the only one in the entire country who hasn't read it. It was published out here first, but it was picked up by newspapers all over America. Now everyone from Bangor to New Orleans and from Chicago to Atlanta is coming out here to hunt for gold. They say there are nuggets out there the size of pecans, and you don't even have to dig for it. clinging to the roots. You just pull up a clump of grass and fill your pockets with solid gold.
Oh, it's that easy, is it?
Falcon just shook his head in disbelief.
Come up to the wheelhouse with me, would you, Falcon? I've got a copy of a newspaper from Bismarck. This isn't the first article they've run, and I don't reckon it'll be the last. But take a look at it, and you'll see what's driving all these fortune hunters.
Falcon climbed the ladder behind Marsh, then stepped into the wheelhouse. There, the pilot, Dave Campbell, stood behind a huge spoked wheel, steering carefully to keep the boat in the deepest channel of the river. The best view of the river could be had from the wheelhouse, which was the highest point on the boat and located just aft of the two fluted chimneys. From up there, there was a 360-degree panoramic view of the river, as well as the wooded banks along either side. Falcon saw three deer come down to the edge of the river. They stood there for a moment, looking at the boat as it passed them by. Then, believing the boat represented no danger to them, they dipped their heads to drink.
Ah, here it is. Take a look at this, then tell me what you think.
Gold in the Black Hills. Great attention is being drawn to the Black Hills. Well-timbered and with a goodly supply of water, the Black Hills are known to be rich with gold, with the nuggets, some as large as walnuts, lying freely upon the ground. A college geology professor, several mineral experts and scientists, along with men who are skilled in the profession of mining, accompanied the expedition. In the beds of these streams, the expedition reported finding gold in copious amounts. Such a source of gold needs no expensive or dangerous mining for extraction, as it can be easily panned, or in many cases, simply picked up as shining nuggets. It is said that a two-hour stroll along one of these streams could produce enough gold to provide the equivalent of a year's income for the average worker.
Is there any truth to this story about gold in the Black Hills?
It's been 2 years since Custer's great expedition into the Black Hills. No gold has been brought out yet.
Has the gold rush been this heavy?
Falcon pointed to the crowded decks of the boat.
No. A few have gone in, some have gotten themselves killed. And I think that is what has kept the gold rush down so far. The gold hunters are afraid of the Indians, and rightly so. But now word is out that Custer will be going after the Indians this summer. And I reckon all the gold hunters figure this is the best time for them to go, seeing as they figure on Custer keeping the Indians busy.
May 9th, 1876, along Buckhorn Creek. Cleet Harris, Jay Bryans, Jim Guerin, and Ken Richland were waiting behind a rock outcropping that pushed down so close to the creek that here the wagon road actually had to run out into the water for a short distance. If someone intended to waylay a wagon, this was the perfect place for it, not only because the rocks provided concealment, but also because at this point the wagon driver would have his hands full negotiating the stream. Harris was lying on his stomach looking through a pair of binoculars back down the creek. He had seen the dust 15 minutes ago, but now he could see the wagon as well.
Do you see the wagon yet, Harris?
Yeah, Bryans, I see it.
Is it carrying the Gatling guns?
Yes, it is.
How do you know for sure? Are they just out in the open?
Sergeant Major O'Leary is driving the wagon. I don't think a sergeant major would be driving if the wagon was carrying nothing more than nails and such.
How much longer?
As slow as they're coming, Richland, I'd say another 10, maybe 15 minutes.
Hey, Harris, how much you say engines give us for them guns?
$2,000 per gun.
Damn! These two of them guns, these four of us, that's $1,000 apiece!
There's five of us counting Potter. That's, $800 apiece.
No, it ain't. It's $700 for each of you and $1,200 for me.
That ain't fair.
You knew the deal coming in. I'm the one that found out about the guns, and I'm the one that went up to the Dakota Territory to meet with Cutnose. Now, if you don't like the deal, you could just pull out now and the rest of us will divide up your money.
No, I didn't say nothing about pulling out.
Harris is right, Richland. We did make the deal with him.
Yeah, I know. I was just commenting is all.
Well, keep your comments to yourself.
Hey, Harris, they're getting a little closer. I can hear them.
Everyone be quiet.
Harris climbed back up onto the rock and looked back toward the wagon. They had made better time than he thought, and were now just over 200 yards away. The wagon was being pulled by a team of six mules, and there were four soldiers riding with it, two in the front and two in the rear. Nobody was on the wagon seat with the driver. Harris jacked a shell into the chamber of his rifle, then nodded to the others, suggesting they do the same.
Bryans,
you go for the soldier front left. Darren, you take the front one on the right. Richlands, you got the back soldier on the right, and I'll take the back one on the left. Now wait until they get into the water, and wait until they're even with us. Otherwise, me and Richland won't have a shot.
The others nodded, then waited. As the wagon drew nearer, the four watched as the driver halted the team.
What the hell's he doing? What'd he stop for?
I don't know.
Let's go get him.
Get down, you fool.
If you give us away, we will never get those guns. We have to wait until they get here, then take them by surprise.
What if they don't come?
They got no choice. They can't sit there forever. When they start up again, this is the way they'll have to come.
Sergeant Major O'Leary, what are we sitting here for?
Still holding the reins, O'Leary raised his hand and scratched his nose as he studied the road ahead.
Look up there. What do you see?
I don't see nothing in particular. The fact is, looks like the road stops there.
No, laddie, the road don't stop. Sure, and I've drove this road before. It's always a bit of worrying I do about here. The road goes out into the creek bed for a bit, then comes back, you see.
Well, how deep does the water get?
It is only 6 to 8 inches is all. That is, if you stay close to the bank.
So, if the road goes on, why have we stopped?
Think about it. If you was a brigand wanting to do mischief by us, now where do you think would be the best place to be?
Right here?
Aye, laddie. Right here.
Well, what are we going to do, Sergeant Major? We can't just sit here all day.
We're going through, laddie. We're going through.
The two lead soldiers went into the water first, followed by the wagon, then the two trailing soldiers.
You men, keep your eyes open.
We're looking, Sergeant Major. We're...
Within a few seconds, all four soldiers were in the water.
Tap! All four!
Harris and the men with him had not expected the driver to react so quickly, and before they realized it, O'Leary was out of the water and on the road, moving as fast as his team could pull him. Richland leveled his rifle at the wagon.
No! Don't shoot!
What you mean, don't shoot?
Yeah, he's getting away! We can't take a chance on killing one of the mules. We're gonna need him to pull the wagon. He ain't going nowhere. Get mounted, let's get after him.
By the time the four men were mounted, the wagon was at least 200 yards ahead of them.
Yeah! Get up here!
Harris rode right up alongside the wagon. Then he raised his pistol. The driver fell forward, but he didn't fall from the wagon. The mules pulling the wagon continued at a gallop. Harris rode up to the lead mule of the team, then reached down and grabbed the harness.
Whoa! Whoa!
You got him!
I thought for sure there he was going to get away.
Harris stared at Bryan's but said nothing. Instead, he rode around to the back of the wagon. Lifting the canvas flap, he looked inside, and then he smiled.
Come get a gander at this, boys. Two guns and two cases of ammunition.
Hey, Harris, what about the ammunition?
What about it?
I know you agreed to sell the guns to the Injuns for $2,000 apiece. Did you say anything about the ammunition?
Damn, Garen! Maybe you ain't as dumb as I thought you was. That's a pretty good idea. Well, we'll charge an extra $500 for a case of bullets.
That's gonna be a total of $5,000. Where Injun's gonna get $5,000?
From the Black Hills.
What do you mean, from the Black Hills?
Oh, haven't you heard? There's gold in the Black Hills.
Injun don't use money.
Well, they don't use money in their own culture, but they ain't dumb. They know that the white folk value gold above everything else, and they know that they can use it to get whatever they want from us.
I just hope they want Gatling guns.
They do, Bryans. Trust me, they do.
May 11th, 1876. Bismarck, Dakota Territory. When the Far West landed in Bismarck, the gold hunters streamed off the boat as if it was a race to get into the Black Hills. Many of them hurried to the livery stable to try to buy a horse. The horses were going at a premium price, but even so, they sold out quickly. There were just too many gold hunters and not enough horses to go around. Falcon walked down the gangplank and was surprised to see Custer standing on the dock.
Well, General Custer... I didn't expect to see you here.
Would you look at these fools? What in the world has gotten into them?
Gold fever.
Yes, that stupid article in the Tribune. It was picked up by newspapers all over the country.
I thought you approved of it. The article seemed to indicate that your expedition was the genesis of all this.
Unfortunately, it was. But the reports we brought back were greatly exaggerated by the newspaper. And with each telling around the country, the reports grow. Some, I think, would have you believe you could just pull up a plant and find gold nuggets like peanuts clinging to the roots.
How many have come here?
Oh, I don't know. Hundreds, certainly. Maybe even as many as 1,000. They are just lucky that all the Indians have moved west to follow the spring grass. If they were here, I wouldn't give a plugged nickel for the life of any of these gold hunters.
Can't you do something about it?
Do what?
I don't know. Stop them from going into the Black Hills, I suppose.
Even if the government would let me do that, which I don't think they would, I couldn't do it, because I don't have the manpower. Within a few days, I'll be leading the 7th on a march to find the Indians who have left the reservation and bring them back. Come on. I'm riding Vic, and I brought Dandy for you to ride back to the post.
Custer led Falcon over to a hitching rail where 2 horses stood.
You should feel honored. Dandy is Libby's horse. She doesn't just let anyone ride him.
I am honored. Dandy's a fine-looking horse.
Your brother and sister get here this afternoon. I'm going to send Tom back into town to pick them up. Tonight, Libby is planning a big dinner. Tomorrow, your brother and sister will perform for us.
I am very much looking forward to the visit.
When Falcon reached Fort Lincoln, Custer took him directly to regimental headquarters to introduce him around. There, Falcon met Custer's brothers, Tom, who was a captain, and Boston, who was a civilian attached to the quartermaster. He also met Audie Reed, Custer's nephew, and Lieutenant James Jimmy Calhoun, who was married to Custer's sister, Margaret.
And these officers are the same as family to me. Captains Yates, Moylan, Keogh, and Lieutenant Weir. And my adjutant, Lieutenant Cook.
Colonel, it is a pleasure meeting you.
Falcon shook Tom's hand, then he glanced toward Custer.
I told him you were a colonel.
But only in the Colorado Home Guard.
Not true. You were given the reserve commission of lieutenant colonel when you were in Washington, weren't you?
I was.
Then you have earned the right to be addressed as and given the respect of a lieutenant colonel.
Colonel McAllister, would you care to go into Bismarck with me this afternoon to meet your brother and sister?
Well, thank you, Captain. I would appreciate that.
Tom, see that Colonel McAllister is provided with a horse. I don't think Libby intended to let him ride Dandy indefinitely.
I'll pick out a good one for you, Colonel.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Lieutenant Weir will show you to your quarters. I hope you find them adequate.
I'm sure they will be more than adequate.
This way, Colonel McAllister.
As they walked from post headquarters to the officers' quarters, Falcon looked out over the parade ground, where he saw scores of men at drill.
Recruits, we are about to launch the largest Indian campaign this nation has ever seen, and we're doing it with a regiment that is more than 60% recruits. All those men you see out there have arrived from Jefferson Barracks no more than 2 weeks ago. Half of them have never even been on a horse. Fewer still have ever fired a weapon, and damn few of them have ever seen an Indian.
Falcon shook his head as he followed Weir across the parade ground toward the long, low building that was the bachelor officer's quarters. Weir took Falcon into the building, then opened the door to one of the rooms. The room had a bed, a trunk, and a table with a kerosene lantern, pitcher, and basin. Falcon's leather grip was already sitting on the trunk.
This is the room General Terry uses whenever he visits the post.
It's very nice. I'm flattered.
Yes, sir. Well, General Custer is taken by you, and he always does right by his friends. Enjoy your stay, Colonel.
Thank you.
Falcon checked the lantern and saw that the little kerosene tank was filled, and because the room was a little stuffy, he raised the window slightly. After that, he decided to take a walking tour of the post. When Falcon stepped into the sutler's store a few minutes later, he saw a major and a captain playing billiards. The major had dark hair, a mustache, and dark eyes. The captain, who looked to be about 10 to 15 years older, had white hair and very pale blue eyes. The captain had a cue in his hand and was bent over the table about to shoot when he looked up and saw Falcon come in.
I take it you would be Colonel McAllister?
I'm Falcon McAllister.
I'm Captain Fred Benteen. This is Major Marcus Reno. Welcome to Fort Custer.
Fort Custer?
Oh, wait. Now, that's right. Custer didn't manage to get the name changed when he was in Washington, did he? Ha! I guess they're just going to continue to call it Lincoln, though I don't know why. Lincoln was nothing but a wartime president, whereas Custer is Custer.
Fred, you'd better watch that kind of talk. You never know when you're going to run into someone who's come under his spell.
Well, you may be right, Marcus. Tell me, Colonel, are you under the spell of our illustrious leader?
I'm not under anyone's spell, Captain.
I see. Well, I think I should probably see how the training is going with my troops. I hope I haven't offended you, Colonel, and I hope your stay is a pleasant one.
No offense taken.
Mr. Smith, I'll be seeing you.
Benteen waved toward the sutler as he left. The sutler, who was inventorying his stock, waved back.
This is just a guess, mind you, but I get the impression Captain Benteen doesn't care much for General Custer.
Reno put his cue back in the wall rack.
You will find that there are two elements on this post. There are those like Cook and Keogh, Moylan, Weir, and a few others who believe that Custer walks on water. And there are those like Benteen who have an intense dislike for him.
And where are you in that picture, Major?
I'm not on either side. I joined the 7th Cavalry too recently to have an opinion, other than that of an officer deferring to his superior. I hasten to add, by the way, that though Benteen dislikes Custer, and I believe the feeling is mutual, my observation is that they have always behaved toward each other in a proper military manner.
Well, now, that's good to hear. A person can't control how he feels, but he can control how he acts.
Would you join me for a drink, Colonel?
Sure, I'd be glad to.
Falcon turned toward the door at the rear of the room.
Where are you going?
Isn't a bar in the other room?
We don't need the bar. I have my own bottle.
Reno took a bottle of whiskey from the pocket of his tunic. He wiped the mouth of the bottle with the sleeve of his jacket and handed it to Falcon.
Here's to you.
Reno took the bottle back.
How long will you be with us, Colonel?
My brother and sister are coming here to perform for the post. I'll stay for that, then probably see the regiment off when you go out on your expedition.
It'll be my first encounter with Indians, you know.
No, I didn't know.
I was in the war. I've been in battle. But that was against sane and civilized men. I've heard what these savages do. How they will torture a prisoner to death just for the fun of it. And how they will mutilate a body. Even their women and children do that, they say. Anyway, I must be going. Important business, I'm sure you understand. Colonel, I hope your stay is a pleasant one.
Oh, thank you, Major.
May 11th, 1876. Bismarck, Dakota Territory. Tom Custer brought an ambulance into town to meet the train. The ambulance was selected because it was well sprung and offered by far the best ride of any vehicle on the post. Tom and Falcon had ridden in with the ambulance, which was being driven by young Boston Custer. The train depot was a busy place, filled with entrepreneurs who planned to meet and do business with the arriving gold hunters, as well as disgruntled gold hunters who had already given up the quest and were waiting for a train to take them away. The train rolled into the station right on time. Falcon watched the passengers get off until he saw Andrew and Rosanna. Smiling, he went toward him and shook hands with his brother and hugged his sister.
Oh, hello, Colonel McAllister. We meet again.
Disengaging from the hug, Falcon turned to see a beautiful young woman smiling at him. It was the same woman he had met in Secretary Taft's office.
Lorena Wood, what you doing here?
General Custer invited me, and I thought it might make an interesting trip. And you?
I came to watch my brother and sister perform. Have you met them?
Yes, we met on the train. I must say, brother, you made quite an impression on her. She was singing your praises until we told her that we were your brother and sister and we knew all your foibles.
But you couldn't dissuade me, could you? I told them, Colonel, that you and I met in Washington. I also told them how courageous and gallant you were when you saved my life.
Oh, all I did now was run a few miscreants off.
Well, you were certainly my hero that day.
My. It looks as if this visit may be more interesting than we anticipated. Think so, sis?
You may be right, Andrew.
Shouldn't we get back to the post?
Oh, I do believe this pretty lady has gotten our brother all discombobulated.
The dining table in Custer's house was extended to its fullest length that night in order to accommodate all the guests. Libby managed the seating arrangement, putting Tom Custer with Rosanna and Falcon with Lorena. Margaret was with Jimmy Calhoun. Libby was with Custer. Custer's brother Boston and nephew Audie Reed, along with Falcon's brother Andrew, completed the party. Custer, as was his right as host of the dinner, was regaling his guests by quoting from memory one of his articles from Galaxy magazine.
Stripped of the beautiful romance with which we have been so long willing to envelop the Indian, transferred from the inviting pages of the novelist to the localities where we are compelled to meet with him, in his native village, on the warpath, and when raiding upon our frontier settlements and lines of travel, the Indian forfeits his claim to the appellation of the noble red man. We see him as he is, and so far as all knowledge goes, as he has ever been. A savage, in every sense of the word. One whose cruel and ferocious nature far exceeds that of any wild beast of the desert.
Excuse me? You see nothing at all noble in the Indian?
I do not, sir.
And yet you have Indian scouts upon whom you not only depend for information, but often for your very life.
Yes, my dear sir, but even those Indians, the Cree, the Crow, serve not for any noble purpose, but for the money we pay them, and also to carry on their ancient enmity with the Sioux.
Brother, I am just happy you were reinstated to duty.
Yes, it would have been disastrous for the 7th had I not been allowed to return in time to lead the regiment on this upcoming expedition. General Terry admitted as much to me. Can you imagine? Grant, that fool in the White House, wanted to put Reno in charge of the 7th. And while I'll admit that Reno fought well enough during the war, he wouldn't have the slightest idea of what to do should the 7th be attacked. It is a totally different thing when you are fighting low.
Low? Who is low?
The soldiers call the Indian low, my dear. It comes from Alexander Pope's essay on man. Lo, the poor Indian, whose untutored mind sees God in clouds, or hears him in the wind, his soul proud, science never taught to stray. Far as the solar walk or Milky Way, yet simple nature to his hope has given, behind the cloud-topped hill, an humbler heaven.
Libby just learned to recite that poem to aggravate me.
Brother, you were explaining why Major Reno would not be up to leading the regiment.
Yes. The Indians, always mounted on fleet ponies, often charge in single file past your camp. They are magnificent riders, and they show that in such a demonstration. They pass by in easy carbine range, but the soldiers, being unaccustomed to firing at such rapidly moving targets, are rarely able to shoot them. The Indians, riding singly or by twos or threes, would, with war whoops and taunts, dash across the plain in a line parallel to that occupied by the soldiers until finally they turn and ride away. And here is where an inexperienced officer, like Reno, would make a fatal blunder. For the inexperienced officer would pursue the fleeing Indians. The Indians would make a great show of trying to get away, all the while leading the soldiers well away from the main body to where they could be surrounded and destroyed by the aid of overwhelming numbers of Indians previously concealed in a ravine until the ambush could be put into play.
General, you tell that story as if you are speaking from experience.
You're right, Colonel. You are absolutely right. As a new officer, engaging the Indians for the first time, I did make just such a mistake.
As long as you don't make such a mistake again.
My dear Sunshine, how flattering it is to have you worry about me after all these years.
I confess to being a little worried. This next scout is a little different from the sightseeing expedition you took into the Black Hills. On this one, you are looking for Indians.
Libby, don't you worry about Audie. I'll watch out for him.
And who is going to watch out for you, Tom?
I have two of these.
Tom pointed to the medals of honor that were pinned to his tunic.
I assure you, I am quite capable of looking out for myself, my big brother, and my little brother.
The dinner soon wrapped up, and each of the guests began to separate into their own groups. The men going into the parlor to smoke cigars and drink whiskey, and the women going out onto the porch to enjoy the night air.
Libby, are you sure there isn't anything I can do to help?
I'm sure you can find something much more pleasant to do. In fact, if I may suggest such a thing, Colonel McAllister, why don't you show Lorena around the fort? I'm sure she would enjoy the tour.
Well, I'd be glad to,
That is, if Miss Wood would be interested.
Oh, I can't think of a better way to close out a delightful evening.
Falcon and Lorena walked down the front steps of the Custer's house, then turned to look back at it. Cream-colored with brown trim, a wide porch spread all the way across the front of the house, then ran down along the left side. It was a two-story house with dormer windows protruding from the roof of the second story. Five chimneys serviced the stoves inside so that the house would stay warm in the winter.
The Custers certainly live in a nice house.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages of being the commanding officer.
Do you have a house like that on the post that you command?
Oh, well, not exactly. My command is a state guard. We have some quarters, but none as nice as these.
They walked away from the quarters and from the stables until they were in the most remote corner of the post on the other side of the parade ground and some distance from any of the buildings. From there, they could see the Missouri River gliding by, the water gleaming a soft silver in the light of a three-quarter moon. Looking back toward the flagpole, Falcon and Lorena could hear a soldier in silhouette. As they stood there, listening to taps, feeling a gentle breeze blow against them with a vaulted sky full of diamonds and a gleaming river behind them, Lorena leaned into Falcon. Falcon put his arm around her shoulders.
That is one of the most moving things I have ever heard.
Yeah, taps can be quite impressive. But that is the last official act of a military day. I'd better get you back before the general sends out a search party.
Oh, I hardly think.
Miss Wood? Miss Wood, it's Tom Custer. Are you out there?
Yes, Captain Custer, I am here.
Alone?
I'm with her, Tom.
Oh, all right. The general was just getting a little worried, is all.
I'll walk her back now.
No need. I can walk her back.
Well, I guess you were right. General Custer did send a search party after me.
May 12th, 1876. The next day, the ballroom was given over for Andrew and Rosanna to hold their performance. Every trooper of the 7th Cavalry, except for those who had special duty or punishment detail, was present. General Custer himself introduced the act.
Men of the 7th Cavalry, as most of you know, I was recently in Washington and New York. While I was in New York, I attended a show in which Andrew and Rosanna McAllister were the principal players. And as I watched that show, I couldn't help but think of you back here. And I wish that you could have been there to watch these two wonderful actors perform. I knew that wasn't possible, though, as we will soon leave for a long scout. But if I couldn't take you to them, I could at least bring them to you. So I invited them to Fort Lincoln, and I am proud to say they accepted my invitation. Troopers, I present to you Andrew and Rosanna McAllister.
Andrew and Rosanna put on a rousing performance for the troops, singing and dancing and even dusting off numbers they hadn't performed in years. And at the end of their show, Andrew treated the crowd to a moving performance of Lorena, as requested by his brother Falcon. There was not a dry eye in the house when Andrew finished his beautiful song. May 13th, 1876, Bismarck, Dakota Territory. Falcon sat in the waiting room of the Bismarck Depot, drinking coffee with his sister, Rosanna. Andrew had gone out onto the depot platform to see about their luggage.
I appreciate the two of you coming out here to perform for the men. I know they really enjoyed it.
Andrew and I enjoyed doing it. You know how much we like to come out west.
When are you going to come back?
I don't know. I suppose when we get another invitation.
No, I mean, when are you coming back to stay?
Darling, I thought you knew. Andrew and I are never coming back to stay. Why, New York is our home now.
Yeah, I thought as much. But from time to time, the family wonders about you.
Ha! Huh. Mama and Papa left on their own while they were still practically children. Believe me, if there is anyone who would understand why Andrew and I have chosen to go our own way, it would be Mama and Papa.
Yeah, you've got that right. But as long as you're out here, you could run down there now, couldn't you? When's the last time you've seen anyone from the family?
We've seen you twice in the last 2 months.
I mean other than me.
I don't know. It's been a while.
Then a visit is due, don't you think?
Oh, Falcon, it would be impossible to go down to McAllister now. Andrew and I must start rehearsal for a new show soon. In fact, we were barely able to make the time to come out here to do this.
All right, I understand.
I didn't want to tell you this, because I didn't want to spoil the surprise, but we are coming out to spend Christmas in the valley. In fact, we have cleared away our schedules so we can spend at least 2 months there visiting everyone.
Well, they'll like that. They'll like that very much.
Well, what about you? When are you going to settle down?
Settle down? What do you mean, settle down?
I mean, get married.
I did get married.
Yes, and tragically, she was taken from you. But you are still a young man, Falcon. Somewhere there is a woman for you, and she may be right here.
Here?
You aren't blind, Falcon. I know you have seen the way Lorena Wood looks at you.
I've also seen the way she looks at Tom Custer.
Have you ever thought she might just be trying to make you jealous?
Uh-huh. Or maybe she's trying to make Tom Custer jealous.
Well, I never thought about that. It could be that you are right. I know that she has decided to stay out here with Libby until the regiment returns.
Well, I've got the luggage all taken care of. We won't even have to see it again until we reach New York.
Is that our train?
It has to be. There's nothing else due right now.
When will you be coming back to New York?
Oh, I don't know. Next time business takes me that way, I suppose.
You could come just to visit, you know.
Don't push it, Rosanna. He's the only one who ever comes as it is.
I guess you are right at that. Sometimes I could almost believe that Falcon is the only brother I have.
What about me? Don't you count me as your brother?
You are my twin.
Yes, I guess I see what you mean.
Give everyone my love.
It's been wonderful seeing you. Do keep in touch, will you, little brother?
Falcon smiled as he watched the pair walk out onto the train platform. It seemed funny for Andrew to call Falcon his little brother, even though he was. It was not only that Falcon was a much larger man than Andrew, his experiences so far exceeded anything Andrew had ever done that he could never think of Andrew as his elder.
Hello? Just a minute, I'll ask him.
Big Grandpa! It's Mayor Presnell! He wants to know if the town can count on you as a guest of honor on the reviewing platform for the 4th of July parade.
I'll be there.
He'll be there. Uh-huh. All right. Bye-bye now.
The phone has been busy today.
Yeah, sometimes I think it was better before we had telephones. Telephones, radio, motion pictures, automobiles, flying machines.
Aeroplanes.
What?
You said flying machines, but they're called aeroplanes.
Oh, well, whatever they're called, they're aggravating. It certainly makes one wonder, though, how different things would have been on Custer's last scout if there had been such a thing as flying aeroplanes and all the other modern contraptions.
Are you tired, Falcon? Do you want to pause for a while or to maybe take a nap?
Oh, no, I'm fine. How about you, Libby?
I'm doing fine. As you know, I have written about this story and lectured about it for years. I must confess that I'm enjoying hearing you tell it from your perspective.
Did your brother and sister get back that Christmas?
They did.
What about the lady, Big Grandpa?
What lady?
What lady? Big Grandpa, you know what lady. The one who came all the way out here to see you. Miss Wood. Did she go back to New York with Uncle Andrew and Aunt Rosanna?
No, she stayed at Fort Lincoln.
Yes. When Audie asked if she would like to stay on as our house guest, to keep me company until the regiment returned from the field, she agreed. In fact, when we made camp out on the Missouri Flats, she came out with us. Do you remember that, Falcon?
Oh, yeah, I remember. And we knew, even before the regiment left, where Miss Wood's heart was.
Where?
Rosie, do you want me to tell this story or not?
Well, yes!
Then don't get ahead of me, child.
May 14th, 1876, Missouri River Flats. All 12 companies of the 7th Cavalry had made camp alongside the banks of the Missouri River. A cold rain fell upon the tents, which were laid out in precise military order, creating puddles of water and large expanses of mud to turn the flats into a quagmire. The largest tent of the encampment belonged to the regimental commander. Libby and Lorena, who had come to watch the regiment depart, were in the tent, listening to the sound of the rain drumming against the canvas.
Would you like a cup of tea? I think it is brewed now.
Yes, on a cold, damp day like this, a cup of tea would be lovely.
Libby picked up the silver teapot.
Oh, what a beautiful teapot.
Yes, isn't it? It was given to Audie by General and Mrs. Sherman. We have so many nice things. Some think it out of place to bring such things into the field, but there have been many times when Audie and I had to live in a tent, much like this one, for months on end. And I always felt that if little things, like this teapot, could give those experiences a little more civility, then why not use them?
Oh, I agree, Libby. And I thank you very much for inviting me to come out with you to watch the regiment depart. I can't imagine anything more exciting.
The General and I are pleased to have you as our guest. But I don't think anyone is as pleased over it as Tom is.
I've been working for the War Department for more than 2 years. Until I came out here, I didn't realize what the soldiers in the fields actually go through. I mean, right now, General Custer is somewhere outside in the cold rain when he could be dry and warm in here with us.
Oh, don't you worry about the General, my dear. Believe me, he is in absolute heaven. He loves the Army. Sometimes I think he loves the Army more than he loves me.
Oh, that is not possible. I've only been here for a few days, but I've heard the way he talks to you and about you. And I've seen the way he looks at you. All women should be so lucky. I should be so lucky.
Maybe someday you will be. I know Tom certainly seems taken with you, though you may be more interested in Falcon McAllister.
Falcon? Oh, no. I don't think so. There is something about him. A deep sadness in his past. I'm not sure what it is, but sometimes, in an unguarded moment, you can look into his eyes and see all the way down to the scars on his soul. Are you cold?
Yes. No. For some strange reason, I am very apprehensive about this scout. More so than any previous scout he has ever made. And what you said just now about a deep sadness seemed to resonate with me a little more than such a comment would normally.
Oh, I am sorry. I had no wish to cause you melancholy.
Don't be silly, dear. I am a soldier's wife. Apprehension and unexplained bouts of melancholy are part of it.